You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
Welcome to this episode of the Daily Vet Life podcast, where we chat with equine veterinarians about the cases they've worked on in their clinics. I'm your host, Alex Beckstedt, Editorial Director of Equimanagement, and today I'm speaking with Dr. Melissa Fenn about West Nile virus. Dr. Fenn is originally from Tucson, Arizona, but spent most of her childhood in South America. She received her bachelor's degree from the University of Arizona and her Doctor of Veterinary Medicine degree from Cornell University. Following veterinary school, she completed a rotating internship at the Mid-Atlantic Equine Medical Center before returning to Cornell for a residency in large animal internal medicine. After residency and obtaining board certification with the ACVIM, she moved to Doha, Qatar, and spent a year working at the Equine Veterinary Medical Center. After her time abroad, Dr. Fenn moved to Lexington, Kentucky, where she worked as a clinical veterinarian and head of the internal medicine department at Park Equine Hospital. In 2021, she joined the team at Littleton Equine Medical Center. Her clinical areas of interest include emergency and critical care, neurology, and neonatology. These interests have translated over to her research focus on transfusion medicine. In her spare time, Dr. Fenn prefers to be up in the mountains or traveling. Thank you, Dr. Fenn, for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here and talk about this really special case that I had a couple years ago. This was actually a case that I saw back in 2023, where it was a year here in Colorado where we just had an unprecedented number of West Nile virus cases in both horses and humans within the state. And so I was hoping to take some time to review the disease, because again, it affects not only horses, but us as well as people, and focusing on kind of the clinical signs, diagnostics available, treatments, and then of course, prevention for hopefully better years in the future.
Great. Well, I'm excited to hear all about it. Do you want to just start by giving us a little bit of background about the patient and how he or she first presented to your team?
Yeah, absolutely. So this was a 4-year-old quarter horse gelding. He actually ended up being the first confirmed West Nile virus case of that season. And like I said, he went on to be an incredibly special patient with everything that he went through. So his history was that he was first seen by his referring veterinarian in August of that year for a left foreleg lameness and generalized irritability, which was unlike him. They took some foot radiographs. They were pretty boring, but just in case the owner had started treating him for a possible foot abscess. And they also started him on some gastroprotectants just because he was acting irritable. But then kind of over the next 5 days, his signs progressed to what they described as this like really funky gait. He was stumbling and he went from being lame on that left front to now completely non-weight bearing. But he did also have a single fever on the 5th day after all of this started, at which point they referred him in to us for further diagnostics and treatment. And some of the relevant history was that he had been recently imported from Arizona in January, so about 8 months prior, and he had an unknown vaccine history at that point.
Okay. So how did you first start working up this case once he arrived?
Yeah, when he arrived, you know, it was a little bit dramatic right from the start. He was in lateral recumbency on the trailer, so he was down and couldn't get up. So we had to back, you know, the owner's trailer up to our isolation unit. And we had kind of a whole team of, you know, our anesthetists and everything to try and get him safely off the trailer into the stall where we could do some more diagnostics and stabilization. His initial kind of brief assessment on the trailer, he had a heart rate of 60, but the rest of his vitals were normal. Interestingly, you know, he was aware of his surroundings. He was, you know, aware that we were in the trailer walking around, moving around him, but he was very hyper responsive to any kind of stimuli. So a normal noise or touch of like a stethoscope would really kind of set him off. And it was interesting, the owner who I, you know, we've now known each other for a long time, but she kept apologizing for his poor behavior. You know, she was like, normally he's like this sweet puppy dog, docile horse, and he was just acting incredibly, you know, irritable, almost borderline aggressive, which, you know, she was almost embarrassed of. And it was just, you know, in retrospect, it all makes a lot of sense. But that was something that was very noticeable when he first got there. With like a sling and some ropes and stuff, we were able to get him off of the trailer and get him into the exam room where we could do more of a thorough exam.
So was there anything top of mind that you were immediately thinking was the cause? I mean, are you thinking like acute neurologic disease, or were you immediately jumping to West Nile virus, or what kind of was your thought process there with your diagnostics?
Yeah, it's a good question. I would say, you know, in general, you know, some form of central nervous system disease, so neurologic disease, was top of the list just based on his clinical signs and the history. The fact that he was unvaccinated definitely put, you know, West Nile virus and some of the other viral encephalitides at the top of our list of differentials. But interestingly, like once we got him in the stall, we found several problems on his initial neurologic exam that put West Nile higher on the list. So for example, some of the problems we found on his initial neurologic exam included a very inappropriate mentation, where he would actually fluctuate between these periods of complete obtundation to where like he'd put his head on the water bucket on the stall to hold himself up. And he'd quickly flip from that to these frantic, almost compulsive walking in circles around the stall. And like I said, the severe hyperesthesia. So you would barely touch him and he would like jump out of his skin. On top of that, he had these episodes of like narcoleptic like episodes where he had very abnormal sleep-wake cycles, almost similar to what you'd see in like our dummy foals with encephalopathies. He also had, once he finally would hold still long enough to watch him, he had these very fine muscle tremors and twitching over his muzzle. And then those fine muscle fasciculations kind of extended down his torso and neck. He was severely ataxic. He had a proprioceptive ataxia that was worse in the forelimbs than the hind limbs. So grade 4 out of 5 in the front and a 3 out of 5 in the hind. And then again, that this profound thoracic limb weakness, where he would have that collapse and non-weight bearing, especially of the left front. And so the things that really stood out on that exam that circle back to your question of, okay, how does this fit in with our suspicion of West Nile is, and I'll talk a little bit more about this later too, but the muzzle twitching and those fine fasciculations that you see over the muzzle and sometimes the torso and the neck, those are very classic of the disease. And also the virus in particular has a predilection for the thoracic limbs. And so different from other neurologic diseases like herpes, where the hind limbs tend to be more severely affected, in this case, the front usually. So they almost do this like reverse downward dog, like a yoga position, because they have worsening of the forelimbs. So those were things just, you know, based on his clinical exam that made us suspicious of West Nile. Obviously not definitive at that point, but things that we were concerned about. You know, of course, there's other differentials that we had. You know, he was some, you know, even though he had an unknown vaccination history, things like EHV, Tripoli, Western, rabies, all of those things were possible. He had also just come from Arizona, which is a hotspot for EPM, and EPM is the great pretender. You know, it can look like anything clinically. And so that was definitely on the list. We also couldn't fully rule out something like a trauma, even though this seemed to have more of a progressive nature, and the fever also made trauma less likely. And then, you know, of course, you always have all of the other weird possible differentials like bacterial meningitis, hyperammonemia, you know, all of those types of things. But he had pretty boring blood work on intake, so those types of problems seemed less likely. But again, I think the muzzle fasciculations, the predilection for the thoracic limbs, the behavior change, and lack of vaccination were really overall what made his case so highly suspicious for West Nile.
For 50 years, Spalding Labs has helped farms control flies naturally. From fly predators that stop flies before they hatch, to species-specific traps, and a botanical fly spray that's safe for people and smells great, Spalding Labs makes fly control simple and effective. Trusted by farms for 50 years. Learn more at info.spalding-labs.com.
So, walk us through how you got to that definitive diagnosis and kind of how you managed this horse along the way. Because I imagine with all these behavioral and physical issues, you're probably having to take special steps to care for him as well.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, with any horse that has a fever and acute onset ataxia, you know, the first thing we have to be doing is calling the state vet. So we did that. And then we got samples for stat testing for pretty much all of those diseases that I mentioned. We made a decision with the owner that we were not going to collect spinal fluid. So we did not perform a spinal tap for two main reasons. One, again, was that our primary differential at that point was West Nile virus. And The one beauty of that disease is that you can actually get a definitive diagnosis off of a blood sample. You don't need CSF. So that's great. And then the other thing is that we were trying to minimize hospital staff contact with the horse until we had finalized his EHV results. He was also, the third reason, I guess, would be that he was clinically unstable enough that we would have needed to anesthetize him to get spinal fluid. And we were concerned he wouldn't be able to get back up again after that. So those were kind of the reasons why we didn't spinal tap him. But the good news is that you can submit a blood test for West Nile virus. And we actually got a definitive diagnosis the following day. But, you know, the important thing with these neurologic diseases, like you mentioned, they're really challenging from a nursing care perspective, and that they're, you know, these huge animals that are falling down all the time. They can hurt themselves. They can hurt the staff. And so while we were awaiting testing results, I can kind of run through our initial stabilization plan. But, you know, we had him on a conservative rate of isotonic crystalloids. I would say in general, if you have the option to choose which type of IV fluids you would want to administer, I would always recommend choosing Plasmalite over LRS if you have the option. It has magnesium in it versus calcium, which has some neuroprotective benefits. It's also an important cofactor in energy metabolism in the nervous system. It antagonizes calcium and just generally is safer and more isotonic for the nervous system than LRS is. We also put in, you know, several neuroprotectants and antioxidants into his treatment plan. So things like thiamine, vitamin C, vitamin E were all incorporated. We gave him Banamine to help control pain and inflammation, and then also started him on oral pentoxyphylline, which has been shown to have some antiviral activity against different viruses out there. And then we also went ahead and started him on Marquee, so the treatment for EPM, just because of his history being in Arizona. We don't see that much EPM here in Colorado, but again, it definitely had cases present similarly like this. And because he came from Arizona, that's why we wanted to do that. And then kind of how he progressed over the course of the night, he did have these repeating episodes of he was falling down. He would be intermittently recumbent. So we had different forms of support, whether it was sling or rope assistance to help get him back up each time. At one point when he was getting less and less able to get up by himself, we did give him a dose of corticosteroids. And so he just had a single dose of that. But by the next morning, he actually slowly started to show some improvement. He was able to stand more consistently by himself, needing less and less assistance each time. And then again, later that afternoon, so about 24 hours later, we did get his blood test back, which showed a positive IgM titer against West Nile virus, which confirmed the disease as the cause of his clinical signs.
So then how did that change your treatment plan, if any?
Yeah, it's a good question. It actually didn't change too much. The one thing was that we went ahead and once we got the negative EPM results too, we stopped the Marquee for that. But otherwise, in general, the treatment for West Nile virus is supportive care. Antivirals in particular haven't been shown to be effective in any way necessarily. And so that's not really something that we jump for. And there's some other data out there about hyperimmune products or even, you know, interferons that can be used, but there's just not really that much data out there in horses. So most of, again, the treatment is supportive care. So it's making sure that they're not going to hurt themselves when they're falling down, not going to hurt other people. Like I said, Banamine, anti-inflammatories, all of the antioxidants and neuroprotectants. Some people will advocate for DMSO. That's something that I don't tend to use as often, but it is something out there that some people will use in these types of cases. But again, it's really just focusing on supportive care. And again, like I mentioned, we had him on pentoxyphylline just because it is something that can show really good antiviral activity. It also improves blood flow, you know, has a lot of different benefits that way.
Yeah. So walk us through the rest of the case and how he progressed.
So he had a little bit of, in terms of his neurologic status, he actually started to really improve. You know, over the next few days, his repeat neurologic exams day by day got better. So he was able to actually stand squarely and bear weight on all four limbs. So he had much less of that thoracic limb weakness and that collapse, especially of the left front. The muscle fasciculations and the ones that went kind of down his torso and neck were almost gone. His heart rate came down. And then one of the really interesting things was how his personality changed back and kind of reverted back to his normal self. And that, again, he really started to act like this calm, sweet horse that the owner had described how he was. He stopped having those narcoleptic episodes and he was way less hyperesthetic. Like, you know, you could touch him and do his physical exams and all of his treatments and he wouldn't jump out of his skin. And so those were all things that were really neat to see in terms of how he progressed each day. He did go on to have some additional complications in that he did develop a septic thrombophlebitis of his left jugular vein where his previous IV catheter was. And so we did end up needing to start him on IV antibiotics, as well as clopidogrel or Plavix, which helps decrease platelet aggregation. We put topical NSAIDs on there like Surpass, and we were hot packing it and lasering it to try and help with that. And those were all things that part of it improved. But unfortunately, the next complication that he developed as a typical internal medicine patient was that he did go on to develop a Clostridial difficile colitis secondary to the septic thrombophlebitis and the antibiotics that we had him on. So we ended up treating him for that with antidiarrheals. We did some fecal transplantations from healthy donors. He was put back on, you know, IV fluids, anti-endotoxic support, and he was incredibly sick from that for about the following week. And then finally, on day 22, we were able to discharge him from the hospital, which was really exciting. He came back 6 weeks later for a recheck. He had regained a lot of the weight and condition that he had lost during all of this. His neurologic exam was actually normal at that point, which is really exciting. And I've been following up with his owner over the last few years. I actually saw him just a couple of weeks ago, but he's currently competing successfully as a barrel racer right now, which is really, really awesome. So again, he kind of went through a lot of it, and he's just a really amazing horse, and that he was such a lovely patient even with all of this. And so just a really cool case for that special
horse.
That's
amazing. I know. Because can't some of these horses have some lingering or long-term effects after they recover?
Yeah, absolutely. And so it's a little bit of a scary virus in that, so the overall prognosis is pretty decent in that most of them can go on to do pretty well in terms of recovery. So that being said, there was a paper that looked at about, you know, like 125 horses in Minnesota, where about 18% of them were classified by their owners as incompletely recovered 6 months afterwards. And so, and that could be anything from some gait abnormalities, maybe behavioral changes, some lingering muscle atrophy, you know, lethargy. Those are some of the things that owners would report. But, you know, almost 20% of them won't completely recover, which is not great. And then the other unique part about West Nile virus that's really important to warn owners when we initially make that diagnosis is that a surprisingly high, like 9% of horses will actually suffer some form of relapse of clinical signs anywhere from like 1 week to 5 months after the initial diagnosis. And we've seen those clinical cases here at the clinic too. We had one that same year. He was a warm blood gelding imported from Europe. He presented, you know, had West Nile virus, wasn't that severely affected, did great, went home 4 days later, and then a week later represented actually with much worse neurologic deficits. He did go on to eventually make a full recovery. He's currently competing still as an upper level performance horse. But again, that is something to always tell people. And we always warn owners at that first visit that, you know, there's about a 10% chance that this could come back again within a relatively short period of time. So another unique thing that this particular virus does.
Yeah. I'm curious, what is the efficacy of the vaccines on the market for this disease? And, you know, how do you have conversations with clients about the importance of vaccination and prevention?
Yeah, vaccination and prevention is the utmost important, you know, most important part of this disease. And, you know, for example, in Colorado that year, we saw like just a staggering amount of cases, both within the horse population and the human population. And 100% of the horses that were affected that were vaccinated to some extent survived. But if they were unvaccinated or had an unknown vaccine history, it's about a, 25 to 30% mortality rate, which is scary and obviously something that we would want to avoid. The data on the human side was also just staggering for that year. So like in Colorado alone, they had 50 human deaths, like over 600 cases. All of those, over half of those needed to be hospitalized, had full-blown signs of encephalitis, on the human side. So really scary. The other issue was that that year we had some significant changes in that we had a lot more rain than we typically do for this state. And so the mosquito populations just went way up. They actually went back and looked and they were 10 times the number of the specific Culex mosquitoes that year in the state. And that's the, the species, the epidemiologists call it the best West Nile virus transmitters on the planet. And so, and then on top of that, all of us that live here in Colorado love spending time outside in the mountains. And so, it's a bad combination, unless you're a mosquito, I guess, or a virus, but for the people and the horses, less so. But I think the reason I bring all of that up is that, we can't control the weather. We can't control the mosquito populations. And so our efforts really need to be focusing on prevention, which the two main aspects of prevention are vaccination and then mosquito prevention. And the great thing is that West Nile virus vaccines have been proven to be incredibly safe and effective at preventing West Nile virus encephalitis. And there's four different licensed vaccines out there. I would really recommend that people go to the AAP website. They have a wonderful outline of which vaccines are out there, when to give them, et cetera. But in general, all of them require a primary vaccination series and then followed by a 12-month revaccination interval. And the tricky part with that is that this initial vaccine series is so important. And what we saw that year in particular is that, let's say we have a lot of horses that come in recently imported from Europe. And we had several cases that year that got the first round of their vaccine series, and they hadn't even had time to complete the full series yet. So over a 3 to 6 week period, and they got infected with West Nile virus at that point in time. And so they, again, the owners were being diligent and vaccinating them, but just between the time of the first shot of their series and before they'd even had time to finish it, they were already infected. We even had one case that happened here in the hospital of a recent import from Europe. So kind of scary how quickly it can happen. Yeah. I think the other issue that year was that the mosquito season started earlier. And so a lot of owners hadn't, scheduled their vaccine appointments for that spring. And so a lot of them, even though they had diligently been vaccinating year to year, maybe, it just happened a little bit early that time. And so that's why they got infected. And so it's kind of scary how quickly the window of can occur.
It is. And I'm sure it's only continuing to evolve with weather patterns and whatnot.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, I would say the other thing is, just general mosquito control is important. This is something that, of course, needs to happen more on like the individual operation level, but trying to avoid, having any kind of standing water on your property is important, at least for the human side of things, dressing appropriately, long pants, long sleeves. They have options for that for horses as well. And then, at least for the human side of things, defending yourself using things like DEET products and things along those lines to help. And then just avoiding peak mosquito time, like don't be outside during, dawn and dusk. Those are the kind of things that they talk about.
Well, is there anything else that you want to share with us about this case or about West Nile in general, or any advice that you'd give practitioners faced with similar cases?
Yeah, I would say that I guess a few things that are really important for me and some of the takeaways that we took out from this case is that the clinical signs themselves can be pretty varied in the sense that we talk about all of the more obvious neurologic signs like, ataxia, seizures, obtundation, those types of things. But I think the tricky part is that a lot of these clinical signs can actually mimic other diseases. So for example, paresis or weakness of the thoracic limbs can actually be really hard to distinguish from a lameness, right? Like if a horse isn't bearing weight appropriately on one of its limbs, is that because it hurts and it's painful, meaning it's you know, has a lameness issue, or is it because it physically can't because it has a neurologic problem? And so like this case was a perfect example in that he actually presented as a lameness, and several cases that we've had are similar in that they come in as, you know, lameness when actually it's an underlying neurologic problem. And then similarly, a lot of these cases, I think at least half of them, we went back and looked at all the data over the last few years, but half of them actually presented as colic. And that's because some of the initial clinical signs can be things like they're fasciculating, they have high heart rates, they're not able to stand still, they're laying down a lot. You know, all of those things are can be hard to distinguish from something like a colic. And so especially that time of year, you know, during peak mosquito season, if the horse doesn't have a known vaccine history, you know, those are just things to be keeping an open mind with. The other thing that I wanted to mention is only about a quarter of these cases actually have a fever. And so it's important to not rule it out as a possible differential just because that horse doesn't have an obvious fever. So those are just a few other things just from the clinical standpoint that would be important to keep in mind.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Dr. Fenn, for coming on the podcast and sharing this case with us.
No, thank you guys. I really appreciate it.
And to our listeners, thanks for tuning in.